Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kim Ives with the newspaper Haiti Liberté, who describes the situation he witnessed in Haiti 6 months after a magnitude 7.0 earthquake killed more than 200,000 people in this poor Caribbean nation. Former U.S. Army Colonel Anne Wright, an activist on board one of 6 boats in the Gaza aid flotilla in May, who discusses what she witnessed when Israeli soldiers assaulted the convoy of ships carrying aid to Palestinians. And Manuel Perez Rocha of the Institute for Policy Studies, who looks at the Obama administration's response to Arizona's new immigration law and the reasons why so many from Latin America emigrate to the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Climate scientists implicated in the so-called ClimateGate scandal of leaked emails in Britain have been cleared in an independent inquiry. The report defends the integrity of the work of the Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia in England, a key center for climate research for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate, the United Nations panel that sets policy on global warming. After examining 1,000 emails, Muir Russell, the panel chairman, concluded, quote, "We find that their rigor and honesty as scientists were not in doubt, but we do find there has been a consistent pattern of failing to display the proper degree of openness." Climate change skeptics who publicized leaked emails, hacked from a server at the University of East Anglia, insisted that basic climate research was corrupted and top scientists breached basic standards of peer review of data. The review commission rejected all these allegations. Over the last 9 months, the ClimateGate scandal eroded public confidence in climate research and rattled Britain's scientific establishment, which has pledged more openness in its research. Venezuela has extradited a Salvadoran man to Havana, who is wanted by the Cuban government as a suspect in a series of bombings in Havana in the late 1990s. Francisco Antonio Chavez Abarca was arrested on July 1st at the Simon Bolivar International Airport while trying to gain entry to Venezuela with a false passport. Chavez Abarca is allegedly linked to former CIA operative Luis Posada Carriles and is also suspected of carrying out a series of bombings in Havana in 1997, one of which killed an Italian tourist. Posada Carriles is currently living as a free man in the United States, despite the Venezuelan government's repeated requests for his extradition. He was convicted in absentia by the Cuban and Venezuelan governments for the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner in which 73 people were killed. According to Venezuelan Interior Minister Tarek El Asimi, Chavez Abarca confessed under interrogation that he had plans to carry out a series of violent attacks ahead of Venezuela's September legislative elections. President Hugo Chavez stated that he thinks Chavez Abarca is Posada Carriles' right-hand man and was acting on behalf of those who support Venezuela's wealthy opposition. U.S. District Court Judge Joseph Toro struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, asserting it unconstitutionally interfered with a state's right to define marriage. Judge Toro ruled in favor of 2 legal challenges in Boston to DOMA, which was signed into law in 1996 by former President Bill Clinton. The ruling only affects the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which legalized same-sex marriage in 2004, but its impact could broaden if the decision is appealed and upheld by a higher court. The first suit against DOMA came from Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley, who claimed the federal law forced the state to discriminate against its own citizens in their right to receive federal benefits such as Medicaid. The group Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD, which charged that DOMA violated the Equal Protection Clause under the U.S. Constitution, filed the second suit. Judge Toro agreed, saying DOMA forces states to discriminate against gay and lesbian couples. Thrilled with the ruling, Mary Bonotto, an attorney with GLAAD, told reporters, "Today, the court affirmed that our country will not tolerate second-class marriage." In the ruling, Judge Toro wrote DOMA violated the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which states that rights not explicitly defined by the federal government belong to the states. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Months ago, on January 12th, the nation of Haiti was devastated by the most deadly earthquake in its history. The hemisphere's poorest nation, battered by this magnitude 7.0 earthquake, saw an estimated 230,000 of its citizens killed under hundreds of thousands of collapsed homes and commercial buildings in the capital of Port-au-Prince and surrounding cities and towns. Another 300,000 people were injured, and 1.5 million people were made homeless by the quake. Despite a flood of international media attention and initial shipments of food, water, and medical aid in January, many of the 3 million Haitians affected by the earthquake remain homeless and without the basics of life, such as adequate food, clean water, sanitation, and medical care. People in Haiti's destroyed cities, still living in makeshift tents in more than 1,300 camps, are frustrated by the lack of coordination between the government and NGOs to deliver aid to those who need it most. Despite pledges of $5.3 billion for reconstruction from around the world, only 10% has thus far been donated. A new commission led by former U.S. President Bill Clinton and Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive has been established to supervise the rebuilding of Haiti's infrastructure and push donors to honor their commitments. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Liberté, who recently returned from a fact-finding visit to Haiti. He discusses the lack of progress in many areas of aid distribution and the determination of many Haitians to take action to improve their desperate situation.
Well, we were looking to see what the mood was on the ground, which is one of complete disgruntlement and dissatisfaction. People are so angry at not just the Haitian government, but the NGO community, the international community. They hear about billions of dollars being promised, and yet their situation is practically unchanged since 6 months ago. They are still living in tents, still living under tarps, and it's absolutely a result of the flaws, we could say, in the problems of Haitian society and of the world system. On the one hand, you have these billions of dollars promised, only a fraction of which has been released, less than 1%. But that comes to several million dollars. But even this has not reached the people, because what ends up happening is it gets lost in the bureaucracies of these NGOs and doesn't trickle down to the people in the camps. There are now 1,350 camps around the city, ranging in size from 20 to 30,000 to maybe several dozen. You see them everywhere. And the government has, with the NGO community, has made a couple of show camps, and the first day we got down there, we went out to the camp called Corai. People may have heard of this. There was a little media coverage. It's in the middle of a desert, which in the middle of the day, it is a furnace. It must be 110 degrees. So this is what's happening in the improved camps. A lot of the problem is fundamentally the question of land. The NGOs say, well, yes, we have money and we're ready to build shelters, but the government isn't providing us land. Well, this is a half-truth, but fundamentally this is the big problem. Haiti now has land, but needs land for the people, for the population. And the problem is that the best land, land that could be used to not just build houses, but could be used for agriculture, to grow food, to begin to redress the tremendous problems of Haiti, is in the hands of these big landowners who are letting it lie fallow, letting it appreciate, waiting to sell it for industrial parks or office buildings or who knows what. And the government should be expropriating this land and using it. And they are not. This earthquake has, in a way, opened the economic fault lines, the class fault lines, if you will, of Haitian society. And what happens in the next couple of weeks will be very interesting, because they've put in place an interim commission, which is essentially composed of foreign bankers, of the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, Inter-American Development Bank, and donor nations, that being the U.S., France, Canada, etc., the same people who carried out the 2004 coup d'etat, and then 13 Haitians, 13 foreigners, 13 Haitians, and they passed a state of emergency law which will allow this commission, this interim commission, to essentially have the powers of deciding what the new Haiti is going to look like. They're going to be the ones expropriating people, and I don't need to tell you, it's not going to be the rich people, it's the poor, and that's what they're doing. They're going, they're kicking peasants off their lands in some areas. And this is the real outrage, one of the real outrages we see in Haiti today.
Kim, are there people organizing in the ground among the people who are displaced all over Haiti? Is there any agitation for a change in direction here and more coordination and more attention to the ongoing misery there?
Oh, there is. Yeah, there is a very vibrant, it's growing in the camps, Scott. It's growing women's groups. There's been a lot of rapes in the camps, and the women's groups are organizing with men to counter that. The groups are fighting the efforts of the Préval government, which has put in place a state of emergency for 18 months, given essentially transferred power to this international commission, and are holding exclusionary elections, elections that are excluding the Lavalas family party. Everybody is up in arms about it. There's quite a groundswell of resistance and response at the grassroots to all the problems. And so despite all the difficulties we're going through, I think that the grassroots organizations may, in fact, have an opportunity to advance their agenda in the coming weeks and months.
That was Kim Ives, an editor and writer with the newspaper Haiti Liberté and documentary filmmaker. Read Ives' articles online at HaitiLiberté.com. Anne Wright is a 25-year military veteran who rose to the rank of colonel, then retired and joined the State Department, where she was second in command when the U.S. opened its embassy in Afghanistan in December 2001. She resigned from the diplomatic corps in protest when President Bush invaded Iraq in March 2003. After her resignation, Wright has been a full-time peace activist with Code Pink and other groups. She was on board the Greek flagship Sfedoni, one of six ships in an international aid flotilla that was trying to break the blockade of Gaza in order to carry tons of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian population there. Israeli soldiers boarded the ships on May 31st, resulting in the deaths of nine activists, eight Turks, and a Turkish American. An Israeli military investigation into the naval raid concluded in a July 12th summary that the killing of the aid flotilla's activists was justified, though the operation was beset by flaws in planning and intelligence. The UN and governments around the world continue to demand a full and impartial international investigation into the incident. Anne Wright recently spoke about her experience aboard the aid flotilla to an enthusiastic capacity audience at the West Haven, Connecticut Library a few weeks after returning from the Middle East. In this excerpt of her talk, she describes what happened when the Israelis boarded her ship and the circumstances surrounding the deaths of the nine activists who were killed aboard the largest ship, the Turkish-flagged Mavi Marmara.
About 4:30 in the morning, Zodiac boats, heavily armed and with commandos, equivalent probably to our SEALs, our Navy SEALs, began approaching the stern of the largest vessel, the Mavi Marmara, and started trying to scale onto the ship. They proceeded trying to get on it by shooting concussion, percussion grenades up into the upper decks, these devices that blow up with a huge sound, with lots of smoke to disorient people, to give them the commandos an opportunity to try to board the vessel with people still being stunned. There was tear gas that was used on the Marmara. On my vessel, We did not have tear gas used on us, but we had the percussion grenades that were fired into the windows of the small ship that I was on. We saw the stern of the Marvi Marmara being approached and the percussion grenades going up from the Israeli commandos, and we saw helicopters coming over their ship. At that point, the captain of the big ship called the captain of our ship and said, "Why don't you try to speed ahead?" Because ours was a much faster ship. He said, "Maybe some of the commandos will follow you, will take off and follow you." So that's what happened. The commandos, some of them followed us. Others did not and stayed right with the Marvi Marmara. Most people don't realize that all six ships were boarded forcefully by the Israeli military, and there was a varying level of degree of nonviolent resistance to the boarding. All of the passengers on all of the ships had already gotten together to determine what level of nonviolent resistance we would give, because you didn't go all the way over to the Mediterranean and spend millions of dollars in material and boats to say, "Oh, welcome, here's a red carpet, come right on." You know, we didn't do that. But we weren't about to use lethal force or anything like that to prevent the Israeli military from boarding. On our ship, 17 people, we decided that we were going to put women out on the railing of our boat. And we did it because when you put guys out there, you know what's going to happen. That testosterone starts moving and all of a sudden the escalation of this. And we didn't want that. So we put women out there who were yelling at the commandos as they came up beside us. The way they came up was actually, it wasn't very difficult for them. As we were speeding for about 20 minutes at 20 knots, we had really moved along and we'd taken several of these Zodiac boats with us. But when a very large light started coming across the bow of our ship, and all of a sudden the captain of the ship pulled off the power and boom, we were dead in the water because a huge ship was in front of us. And the captain later said, "That was it. We were not going to jeopardize the lives of people on our ship by this. It was time to stop." So that gave the Israeli commandos easy opportunity to try to board the ship. But we had the women that were standing there. "Get off our ship. We didn't invite you on this ship. Get on your ship. It's 70 miles. We're in international waters. You have no right. You're a pirate if you come on our ship." Well, what do you think happened? Boom. The women were run over. As commandos, whether they're Israeli commandos or American commandos. When these kids, and they're 18, 19, 20-year-olds, they're kids. When these kids with all of their thump, you know, and they've been told, "You take control of that ship," then they take control of it. We had one woman that was shot in the face with a paint bullet. Thank God it wasn't a lethal, it wasn't a regular bullet, as they started using on the Marvi Marmara very quickly. There are a lot of questions that an investigation needs to find out about. What were the rules of engagement? It only took about 20 seconds for them to gain control of our ship. On board the Marmi Marmara, a lot of other things were happening. While our ship was under Israeli control within 20 seconds, on the Marmara, as you probably saw, as the helicopters came over that ship, the commando started rappelling out of the helicopter. The video that we've all seen was a pretty brutal one, where the commandos were coming down and there were guys on the upper deck that were hitting them with sticks and rods and a couple of chairs. What happened? What caused that reaction to happen? Well, one of the things that an investigation has to inquire in was there gunfire, lethal gunfire, coming from the helicopters. And an Al Jazeera reporter who was standing up on the top says, right next to him was a Turkish gentleman who was shot and fell and was just bleeding profusely all over that upper deck. And if that is true, and I have no reason to doubt the reporter saying that, then there may be a reason why the response all of a sudden turned, that people were picking up sticks and were hitting the soldiers or the commandos as they came down. If they had already seen that somebody had been killed, that there was blood all over the thing, why were the soldiers doing that to this group of unarmed civilians?
That was Ann Wright, a former Army colonel and U.S. diplomat, now a peace activist, who was aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. For more information on the Free Gaza Movement, one of the groups coordinating the Gaza Aid ships, visit their website at freegaza.org. Thank you. President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder recently announced that the Department of Justice will sue Arizona for its new immigration law that many charge will result in racial profiling of Hispanic citizens. The lawsuit was initiated because Holder believes the Arizona statute impinges on federal jurisdiction over immigration enforcement. The Justice Department has made it known that it will be monitoring any actual incidents of racial profiling after the law, SB 1070, takes effect on July 29th, which could initiate additional legal action. Despite widespread vocal opposition and anger against the Arizona law among America's Latino community, a recent CBS News public opinion poll found 57% of Americans surveyed believe the Arizona law is about right in the way it addresses the issue of illegal immigration. Although President Obama and some Democrats in Congress had hoped to use the controversy over the Arizona law to bolster support for a debate on comprehensive immigration reform legislation, there are many others who fear a voter backlash. They believe that the faltering economy and high unemployment rate has made immigration a hot-button issue for many citizens who feel illegal immigrants are taking American jobs. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Manuel Perez Rocha, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who looks at the Obama administration's response to Arizona's new immigration law. He also examines the effect of free trade policies that he maintains is a prime motivator for so many from Central and South America to immigrate to the U.S.
Well, so far, I think, it's a very important political stance from President Obama. I think it's making it clear to other states in the country that that it is an anti-constitutional initiative in the case of Arizona, and other states shouldn't follow suit. Of course, there is a great risk that, and other states are already considering applying a similar initiative. But I think Obama at least is showing a good degree of honesty and trying to respond to his pledges during his campaign that he would work towards supporting immigration reform. I think he's doing the right thing, but I think he's very constrained politically. Also, we've had responses from the Democrats now that some Democrat senators and representatives that are worried about, and governors that are worried about the political implications that this might have for the next elections. No? So I think Obama is also risking a lot in supporting the bill for immigration reform and in criticizing and sending and suing Arizona for the illegal and anti-constitutional initiative.
From your point of view, what's the biggest issue in terms of this Arizona immigration law? What's the biggest problem that you have with it?
Well, I'm just writing an article about how there is a very big debate in the United States about immigration now. It's becoming one of the main themes in the public debate. And even when I think that Obama is doing the right thing by supporting immigration reform and criticizing and suing Arizona for the initiative, I think that the U.S. immigration debate, unfortunately, is ignoring a fundamental question. And this question is, why do so many people migrate here from Mexico and other Central American countries? And why this immigration has been rising in the last years? Maybe it's kind of stopped from 2009 and 2010 because of the economic crisis and the very strong slowdown, the economic slowdown here in the United States. But from, I'm just going to put some figures, from 1994, when the North American Free Trade Agreement came into effect, to 2008, the rates of migration from Mexico to the United States were about 500,000 people per year. This was a jump from previous years, from before NAFTA, when the migration rates were about 200,000 or 250,000. So migration to the U.S. only from Mexico has doubled since the entry of the North American Free Trade Agreement. So I think here is that the fundamental question about the push factors, what are the factors that push people out of their home countries, out of their livelihoods, are not being taken into consideration in the debates. I think it will be very important to get the debates about trade agreements, about NAFTA and CAFTA, and the pledge that Obama did before his campaign. These issues get them integrated into the debates about immigration, because immigration will continue. I mean, migration and immigration into the United States will continue unless there is a dramatic shift of economic policy.
Manuel, talk a little bit more about, let's say, a community in Mexico where people used to work on agriculture, maybe growing corn. What's happened with the dumping of U.S. Food crops into Mexico under free trade that has undermined the ability of the average Mexican to get work in agriculture in their hometowns?
You know, it's not only NAFTA. Before NAFTA, during the last 30 years, Mexico and other countries have followed these recipes known as the Washington Consensus, right, because they are enforced, well, they are designed and then enforced and pushed by institutions from Washington like the World Bank and the IMF, etc. In the last 30 years, Mexico and other countries in Central America and elsewhere that have followed these recipes have eliminated support mechanisms to local producers, while at the same time, through free trade agreements, they have allowed big transnational companies to come in and import cheaper products into their countries. This has meant, for example, in Mexico, the arrival of cheap corn and other basic food staples like beans, like wheat, which crowded out local production and ultimately forced millions of small farmers off their land. I mean, the social tissue is completely destroyed, and the families have migrated from the countryside to the cities looking for jobs. And then, you know, it is not only in the countryside that NAFTA has had a terrible effect. Another result of NAFTA is that tens of thousands of small and medium companies, which provide about 90% of Mexico's jobs, have wound up bankrupt due to the lack of financial support, such as bank loans or credit. You know, credit has been totally squeezed in Mexico, and the state development banks have been have been dismantled, both for the countryside as well as for the small and medium companies. So what we have in Mexico is an economy, both in the countryside and industrially, that has been completely denationalized.
That was Manuel Perez Rocha, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and a member of the Mexican Action Network on Free Trade. Read Rocha's articles online at the Institute's website, ips-dc.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.